Tom. We're studying Daniel 11, but let me quickly run through chapter 10. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 are all one big prophecy. And it's all one big event. It's broken into three chapters because it focuses on three different aspects of the event. Chapter 10 is about the process of getting the prophetic word to Daniel and the geopolitical struggle, this geopolitical spiritual struggle that went on at that time, which helps reveal to us what is going on even at our time in the geopolitical spiritual world. It's important for us to know this. Chapter 11 is the near-term prophetic word given to Daniel concerning Israel over the next 300-400 years. And then chapter 12 is the eschatological part of the prophecy, which talks about the end time. It's actually the shortest portion of it. So real quickly, to summarize chapter 10, in 536 B.C.
What page are you on?
I'm on page 60 now, but their text is on 65, but I'm starting on page 60. I'm going to run forward just pretty quickly. In 536 B.C., Daniel has a vision. And he prays the Lord would show him what to do, or what's going to go on with Israel in the future. He's concerned because the reports of the people who have gone back to Jerusalem by now are not good. Instead of hearing that they've gone back and they've established a wall and the temple and whatever, he hears that there's infighting among them and the work has ceased. They're no longer building what they set out to build, and that it's a political nightmare, whatever. And so he's concerned and he prays. Now, he is by the river Tigris with some brothers praying. It's not uncommon for Jews to do this because their prayer times often are associated with ablutions, with washing themselves. So they were down the river Tigris praying, and this angelic being appears. And when it does, Daniel can see him. The others can sense his presence, and they run away in fear. Daniel goes flat on his face in kind of like a trance, and then he is lifted up. And he is told that 21 days earlier, when Daniel began to pray, that he, the angelic being, was sent with the answer to his prayers. But for the last 3 weeks, the prince over Persia has been resisting the messenger from bringing Daniel the answer. Now, by the prince over Persia, he's referring to an angelic being, a spiritual being. The angels were created in a military-like hierarchy, what we would call sergeants and lieutenants and colonels, captains, you know, all that. They're called principalities, powers, thrones, dominions, etc. In Bible, which they derive actually from Persian military. But there's a prince or principality over Persia. The way that when Satan and his angels fell, they fell en masse as a group. And so Satan, who cannot be everywhere at one time, he can only be one place at a time. He has assigned, as it were, his angels around the world, his fallen angels, his demons around the world, in a hierarchical structure designed to make it most efficient for him to destroy mankind. And a principality is as an angel who is in charge over a large region, very often a nation, and then he has lower level angels or demons working for him over cities and, you know, over people's communities, etc. So when, you know, someone says, well, the devil made me do it, they don't really mean Satan. They mean some demonic imp lower down on the totem pole, because Satan's going to be busy where the centers of power are. And if you read Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, you get it's a metaphorical story, an allegory about an older demon teaching a lesser experienced demon how to destroy people, humans. And so you get this hierarchical thing. So the principality over Persia, which outranked this angelic messenger, was able to resist this messenger until Michael, the archangel, came and drove him away. Michael, the archangel, is the one of the three archangels, and his assignment seems to have been as the personal servant and the head of one-third of all the angelic host, in service of the second person of the Trinity, who became Jesus. And he is also known as the defender of Israel because of Jesus. So Michael came and pushed this principality out of the way so that this angel could bring this message to Daniel. And that's what chapter 10 was largely about. He tells him that the vision is for future days, both near and future and latter days. He tells him that God has given him the answer to his prayers, what is going to happen to Israel. Now, Daniel's concerns are always about Israel. And Daniel's prophetic word is always centered on Israel. It refers to other nations and everything, but only as they relate to Israel. In fact, almost all end-time prophetic word is focused on Israel, including Jesus in Matthew 25, I think it is, where he talks about the end times. He's actually talking about Israel. Sometimes the Gentile nations are mentioned, but only as they relate to Israel. Daniel 11, this is the angel speaking. In the first year of Darius the Mede, which is 536 B.C., I rose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. Daniel 11 is one of the most complex prophetic words given anywhere in the scripture in terms of its sheer detail. It reads a whole lot, as you would go through, like something that Nostradamus would have brought out. There's these constant references to this person, this person, this person, this person, all in code. And the only way that we really have to understand it is to look at the history that comes after it. And what we see is it just all falls into place. It just fits like a glove. But to hear the prophecy and understand what it was going to mean would have been almost impossible, because it's one thing for someone to prophesy that a Messiah is coming, but these prophecies are layered, 10, 15, 20 steps deep. And to catch all of those in order in advance is not likely. So the details of Daniel's vision announced in chapter 10 are found in the last two chapters of the book of Daniel. It concerns both the near-term and eschatological futures of Israel, eschatological meaning end time. It outlines the political forces arrayed against Israel going forward. Daniel's always focused on Israel and her national future. Many scholars believe that Cyrus the Persian is also Darius the Mede. So when it talks about Darius, he's also talking about Cyrus the Great. He would have been identified uniquely in both cultures. Remember, these people are coming up in multiple cultures. In the case of the Persians, it's the Medes and the Persians. So they'll have names and identifiers in both. You're familiar with the fact that Peter was called Simon. He was also called Cephas because he was called Aramaically one thing, Hebrew another, and Greek another, Cephas. Paul was known as Saul and Paul, depending on which culture he came from. And Carlos Estevez, brother of Emilio, is known as Charlie Sheen, but his mama calls him Carlos, because that is his name. So this is an example. A succession of four kings is now foretold. Cambyses from 529 to 522, Pseudo-Smerdis for 6 months in 522, Darius the First, the Histopes, Histospes the Great, 522 to 486, and then Xerxes, which is the Greek name for the Persian name Ahasuerus. He was called by the Persians Kaiarsh as well, and a major thorn of the Greek city-states. Xerxes ignites the passions of Greece to conquer Persia in its vassal states. It is the behavior and the actions of Xerxes, Ahasuerus or Kaiarsh, that causes these city-states to finally pull together. Just a little history here. We're in 486 with Xerxes. In 490, You have the Battle of Marathon. You remember the Battle of Marathon, where the Greek runner runs and tells the Athenians that they won. In 480, Xerxes is defeated at Salamis, and he goes home, and licking his wounds, he decides to play around in his harem, and so he winds up creating contest on who shall be queen, and Esther arises in that particular context. So this is the king who marries Esther. Then you have these independent city-states that are not pulling together. They're loose affiliates, and they're fairly beatable until 359, when Philip of Macedon, which was the northern section of what we now call Greece, goes through and unites the southern section, which is called Achaia in the ancient world, but was all these various city-states, Sparta, Athens, and many others. And they finally become totally united in 359 by Philip of Macedon through a series of wars, so that you begin to have a country called Greece. And in 336, Philip of Macedon is assassinated. And his son Alexander takes over, becomes Alexander the Great. And in the next 13 years, Alexander conquers Persia and the then known world. So just to give you perspective. Daniel was a kid, a teenager, in 605. And he lived 80-some years. So add about 70 to 605 and you get 535, something like that. And this is 536 when he's getting all of this. This is at the end of his life. Any other questions?
Xerxes' name is called by the Persians. How did you?
Kaiarsh.
Wow. Okay, so the SHA doesn't mean anything in there.
It's silent like the P in swimming. You know, I just got back from Kenya, and many of the names there are spelled with an N that you never pronounce. Dondo, one of Charles's daughters, is spelled N-D-O-N-D-O. Several of the grandchildren, including Anne and Esther, her name is Thenya, is spelled N-T-H-E-N-Y-A. Many of these cultures don't pronounce many of the letters in their names. Yeah. Well, there you go. Besides, I don't know. You know, I don't know what in the world you would say to K H S H. You know. But very often, you know, those letters are symbols anyway of something. Okay. So his defeat at Salamis caused him to take comfort in his harem. The failure of Vashti to honor him by showcasing her wares at a public drunken feast got her deposed as the queen in Esther 1. He is the king of the time of Esther, who is named as replacement queen. You all know that story, right? You know all the story. All right, Daniel 11, verse 3. Now, this is where the starts. A mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside them. So we were talking about Xerxes or Ahasuerus, and then a mighty king arises. This is Alexander the Great. 150 years after this time of Daniel, Alexander the Great and his Greeks conquered the Persians. The campaign took only 13 short years, from 336 to 323. He was only 33-year-old when he died, leaving behind two small children who quickly met with accidents. In 323, when he had finished conquering the world, they had a drunken party that lasted a year, and somewhere in some stupid swordplay, he wound up dead. Alexander Empire is divided among four generals. The north, Babylon, Iraq, and Palestine, was ruled by a man named Seleucus. He is one of the two very important ones. And the south, which is largely Egypt, the Sudan, all that area, is ruled by a general named Ptolemy. Once again, the P is silent like the P in swimming. Okay. Ptolemy. The east, which is Thrace and Bithynia or Asia Minor by Lysimachus, you're not going to hear much about them at all. And the west by Cassander, and mainly that's Macedonia, Greece, Western Europe, and Rome. Now, at the early part of all of this narrative, Rome is nobody. But that begins to change over years.
Wayne, I know Linda was looking for those maps that kind of went over this territory.
That just gives you the map of the world. But you can see that, you know, Rome is in the west. Seleucus' territory is north of Israel. Ptolemy's territory is south of Israel. And Lysimachus is between Seleucus and Cassander. Now, for our purposes, this discussion, it's mostly going to be north of Israel and south of Israel. Alexander is killed. His four generals execute his two sons. We're going to hear a little bit about Rome later on. We're going to hear nothing about Lysimachus in between there. We're going to hear a lot about Seleucus, which is north Syria, modern Syria, and north of Israel, and a lot about Ptolemy, which is Egypt and south of Israel. Seleucus and Ptolemy are the two major players here. Then the king of the south will grow strong, and this is typical of this prophecy. The king of the south, the king of the north, the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great domain indeed. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. So that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The answer is Ptolemy the First, whose actual name is Soter, because the word's Ptolemy and is a royal name. It's like Pharaoh or Abimelech. It just means they're all called something or another, but they have a real name. So Ptolemy the First emerges as a strong fourth with the help of Seleucus. So these two generals who have been allies under Alexander, they get established in this area, and they help each other at first. Seleucus helps them. And so they gain control of this vast empire about 312 BC. So they get pretty well ensconced. Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, whose actual name is Philadelphus, marries Antiochus II, the grandson of Seleucus I, in 252. And in doing so, she displaces Antiochus' first wife, Laodice, and her son. Now let me slow down here just a minute. All of the Seleucid kings, so the descendants of Seleucus are called the Seleucids. The descendants of Ptolemy are called Ptolemaic Egyptians. Okay. So all the Seleucid kings are either named Antiochus or Seleucus. So usually the firstborn would be Seleucus and the secondborn would be Antiochus. Of course, your major city in the middle of all of that empire is Antioch. We also see that when Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, marries Antiochus II, the grandson of Seleucus I, she displaces his first wife, Laodice. Now you've heard of the Laodiceans, right? And this is one of the seven cities in the book of Revelation is the Laodiceans. Well, that was named after this woman, Laodice. In the process of making a treaty, Ptolemy II gives his daughter Berenice to Antiochus II, and they just dispose of Laodice and her son in the process. But she, as Berenice, will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power. But she will be given up along with those who brought her in and one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. So there's a bunch of references to fathers, sons, daughters, and etc. One of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their descendants of her line, come against their army, and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. Also, their gods and their metal images, their precious vessels of silver and gold, he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. Now, the actual outworking of that is, upon the death of Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, Berenice was deposed and murdered along with her supporters by Laodice, the first wife, and her son, Seleucus II. Berenice's brother, Ptolemy III, whose name was Eurgetes, avenges her death and defeats the Seleucids. He executes those who murdered Berenice, conquers the Syrian capital. He loots Damascus and Antioch of many treasures and sends them home to Egypt. He then agrees to a 10-year truce with Seleucus II and goes home to Egypt. So this prophetic word, which is cryptic, actually works itself out in these exact terms. Verse 10, his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces. So the sons of Seleucus II, remember we're going down the list of kings and their sons. His sons, Seleucus II's sons, will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces. One of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. And the king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given in the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up. He will cause 10,000s to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will pass on with a great army and much equipment. All right. The sons of Seleucus II, Seleucus III and Antiochus III, remember we said that the Seleucid sons are going to be Seleucus and Antiochus. They raise armies against Egypt. Ptolemy IV, whose name is Philopater, a peaceable man and a good general, defeats them handily. He kills over 15,000 Syrian troops in 217 B.C.
That's a peaceable man?
Pardon?
That's a peaceable man?
He'd run into a bad.
Well, he's been attacked by the Seleucids. So he would have minded his own business if they hadn't attacked him. I mean, I think that Roosevelt was a peaceable man, but he attacked Hitler. Right? So, no, he was not a warmonger. He was not trying to get territory. In fact, you'll see here that after he defeats the Seleucids, he fails to consolidate his hold on Palestine because worldwide dominion was not his goal, which is what that last prophetic line means. Does that answer your question? I'm a peaceable man, but you come into my house and attack my wife, I'm going to hurt you. Daniel 11:14. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. But the king of the south is always going to be Egypt. The king of the north is always going to be the Seleucids. Because they are south and north to Israel. Remember, Daniel is about Israel. So when he's talking about north and south and east and west, he means concerning Israel. The east is pretty much dead at this particular point in time. The Babylonians and all Medes and all those people, the Assyrians, they've pretty much, that's not a nice thing to say, they've pretty much exhausted all of their power. The king of the north will come and set up a siege mound and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his mind, in his hand. All right, so we have these people coming against the Egyptian king, including violent ones among Daniel's people, it says here. The Jewish insurgents futilely attempt to drive Ptolemy out of Israel. What happens with Israel is they become the middle ground in which everything is fought. It's like the state of Kentucky, from which I came, was the dark and bloody ground because it was the battleground for many of the tribes that surrounded it. So most of the big wars of the Indians in that area, Cherokee, Seneca, and all that, were fought in Kentucky because it was the battleground. Well, Palestine becomes the battleground between the king of the north and the king of the south, between the Seleucids, which is the Syrians and those people, and the Ptolemaic Egyptians. And what happens is sometimes when these kings come through on their way to attack the other one, sometimes they conquer Israel and stay or then leave. Sometimes they come to Israel's rescue and then stay or leave. So we're told about this one here, that these Jewish insurgents rise up to drive Ptolemy out of Israel. Because the last time he went through, he stayed. He left an army there. When Ptolemy IV dies, Antiochus III raises up yet another Syrian army and drives the Egyptians out of Palestine in 201 B.C. He enters Jerusalem to the delight of the Jews in 198 B.C. He reaffirms the Jewish religion and its practices, which had been suppressed by Egypt. He dwells there for a season as a defense against the Egyptian resurgency. So the Egyptian Ptolemaic leader, when he had gone through to attack Syrians, he had remained behind. He left an army behind in Palestine, subjugated the people, and attempted to destroy the Jewish culture. The insurgents among the Jews rose up to try to drive him out and failed. So what happened is that the Seleucid king from the north, Antiochus III, comes in to deliver the Jews from the Ptolemaic Egyptians, drives Ptolemy out, reestablishes the kingdom of Israel as its own nation under the protection of the Seleucid king in the north, and allows them to reestablish their religion. Now, one of the things that we see going on here in all of this is the reason that the people in Israel are so much trouble is almost always related to their religion. What happens is that when these groups come through and they want to take over, they can't get them to stop being Jews. And because they are Jews, they won't cooperate with them either militarily or culturally. And so there is an effort on the part of many of these conquerors who come in and out to try to destroy the Egyptian, the Jewish religion and its practices. Now we're going to see this in a minute when we get to Antiochus IV, and we're going to see it in spades. This is something Jesus was talking about back in Matthew 25. We'll get there. But just realize that as these groups come through, they're either for Israel or against Israel. Usually, they're seeing Israel as just a pathway. You know, there's not that much in Israel they want. But they're seeing, you know, it's this roadway. They're seeing it's this pathway back and forth, you know, battleground. And some of these conquerors that come through are benevolent. They're just passing through to get to somebody else. And they treat the Jews halfway decently. And others of them are looking for conquest. And they figure a good place for North Egypt would be the border of Syria. So, you know, that's what's going on. And we have this first group of insurgents, yes.
Is this kind of akin to what was going on in that movie A.D., where Pilate was there for Rome and he was trying to...
No, well, yeah, not really. First of all, the movie A.D. is a pile of hoo-ha. I mean, first of all, you know, Caligula never, ever came to Jerusalem. That's just stuff. But most of what was in there is just stuff. It was good Hollywood, but it was not good Bible at all. Some of it was okay. Pilate was never as mean as that guy portrayed him. And those two women never had that kind of power in that particular world. They'd have been Cleopatra. They'd have been the queen of Egypt if they had that kind of power. And even she had to do it by more subtly than that. So they showed a very westernized kind of a scenario where you have these two very strong women running the place. And it's not even close to being right. So it was good theater, you know. It was like Survivor episode 19, you know.
Right, but I was just thinking of, as far as fighting though for the territory, you know, like the Jewish people were trying to keep
the Israel to the Romans was an outpost. They could have bypassed it and never missed it. It was a nothing place. It wasn't on the road to any place for them. It was. I mean, when Pilate was given Israel as his, or Jerusalem particularly as his place of government, mm-hmm. It was because, see, the Romans installed these Jewish kings, the Herod family, right? And the Jewish kings were actually half-Jewish, half-Idumean. All right, so the Romans installed them just to manage all that. They didn't care enough about it to even send one of their own. Well, what happened is that one of the Herod's sons didn't do a very good job, Aristobulus. So Rome sent a procurator to manage Jerusalem because it was a hotbed of activity around the temple and all this kind of stuff. The Jews were constantly fighting, you know, with whoever was there. So they sent this procurator there. Well, now the Jewish kings, Herod and Philip, whatever, despised the fact that that guy was in there. But it was an outpost, though. It was a bump on the butt of a hippo somewhere. And Pilate thought of it as a nothing assignment. The only reason he got it was because the present emperor was basically on a holiday, about a 10-year holiday to the Isle of Capri, and he left behind a guy named Sejanus to run the empire. And Pilate was an ally of Sejanus.
Okay.
And, you know, otherwise he would have, you know, it was a nothing. They hated it, especially Jerusalem. You know, if they could stay in Caesarea, it wasn't so bad. But the what we're talking about, these two kingdoms had to constantly go through Israel to get to each other. In order to get to Israel, the Romans had to go way out of their way to get to Israel. It was mostly what they didn't want was to have some trouble over on this particular. They just wanted them to be at peace.
Right.
And, you know, they tried to stomp out the religion, couldn't do it, so basically made concessions to the religion up to a certain point. They established their own people in the temple as the Sanhedrin. You know, they tried to rule it politically, and they tried to compromise with it, and they tried, for instance, not to violate the temple grounds itself. The Caligula sending that statue actually happened, but it never got that far. Because he died, and it I don't know what happened to it, but it was whatever. So AD is probably one of the worst things I've ever seen in terms of as a biblical presentation. For instance, the character they had playing Paul was an absolute total idiot.
He was.
He was nothing like the biblical Paul at all, either before or after. Before or after his, he was a maniac. And Paul was never anything like that. Paul was zealous, but he was a reasoned lawyer. He was a student of Gamaliel. Can you imagine this Paul in this movie being a student of Gamaliel? And not even close. He's not a student of anybody. He was just an idiot. So, yeah, it was a mess. Hope you enjoyed the show. Well, no, I mean it's good fiction.
Oh, I don't want to implant fiction.
Just don't read your Bible into it because it's not there.
Okay.
All right, I'm on Daniel 11:17, I think. So Antiochus III is friendly to Israel. He goes in, reestablishes, reaffirms the religion, and stays behind to protect them. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. And he will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But he will not take a stand for him, but she will not take a stand for him, be on his side. Now, we're talking about Antiochus dealing with the Ptolemy there, okay? I'll get to it. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn, so he will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land. He will stumble and fall and be found no more. Antiochus III offers a truce and his daughter in marriage to Ptolemy V, whose name is Epiphanes. Her name was Cleopatra I, not to be confused with Cleopatra VII, who was the queen of Egypt during the reign of Julius Caesar. Cleopatra is actually not an Egyptian name. Most of the early Cleopatras were not Egyptian. They were Greek or Seleucid or whatever. She was supposed to be her father's eyes and ears in Ptolemy's court. I think we discussed several times before that when kings would make treaties, they would make marriages with daughters and stuff, and that are hostages, they were sometimes called, and they were designed to try to work the politics of their father into the nation where they're marrying, right? So if Germany wants to make a treaty with England They seal the treaty by the English king giving his daughter to a German prince as a kind of a hostage. And then what happens is that German, that English princess daughter is supposed to work behind the scenes for English interests. And that's what they often, you know, tried to do. In this particular case, the daughter that he gives to Ptolemy joins Ptolemy against her father. She likes her husband more than her father. Many of these royal daughters throughout history were prepared as political pawns. They were trained to be political pawns, and not all of them appreciated it. So in some cases, you have a good example is Victoria and Albert. Albert was a Saxon baron that was supposed to keep Victoria in line vis-a-vis the German interests. But Victoria and Albert fell in love with each other and basically thumbed their noses at the German interests. That's a little strong, but anyway. So she was supposed to be her father's eyes and ears in Ptolemy's court, but she unexpectedly sides with her husband against her father and undermines the truce. So instead of having peace, she basically helps to incite her husband to war. Antiochus then moves to capture and fortify Asia Minor, Anatolia and Galatia on the Mediterranean Sea. That's, he goes sideways. Remember I said we wouldn't have do much with Lysimachus? Well, at this particular point in time, Antiochus decides that it's his best interest to broaden his kingdom out to the west. And so he comes against Anatolia or Galatia. Let me see. If you see on the map there's something in red that says Turkey.
Yeah.
To the right of it is Galatia. Okay? And to the right of that is the Seleucid Empire. So he's moving from the left-hand, the right-hand corner of the page where it says Syria, left, to try to, here you go, to try to enlarge his empire, mostly for tax purposes. Why? Because all these wars cost money, especially if you don't win a lot when you win the war. Now, what happened is, when he moved west, he drew the attention of the Roman general Scipio. Now, where are they coming from? Further west. So, during all of this battle back and forth over Palestine, the Romans have been gradually emerging and gradually causing their empire to become strong. And they've moved their hegemony east so that they are heavily influencing what's going on in Asia Minor. And when Antiochus moves west, he bumps up against the Roman interest, and this general Scipio in 190 defeats him. That's where he was talking up above about the scorn. The commander put a stop to his scorn against him and will repay him for his scorn. That's what that means. This was the beginning of the Roman hegemony in the area of Palestine. Up until this point, Roman never had any influence in the area at all. Antiochus is killed in 187 while looting a temple in Susa to raise a tribute money for Rome. Susa may be on this map. Susa is the old capital of the Medes. It would have been farther to the right. So Antiochus is killed while he's looting a temple in Susa in order to raise tribute money to pay Rome so that Rome will go away. So he moves east in order to raise money because his wars are too expensive. He winds up getting into a war he didn't expect with the Romans. He gets defeated. Now they want tribute. So now instead of being short of money that way, he's short of money both ways. And so he's going over farther west to get money to pay the people on the east. And when he goes into a temple and begins to loot its wealth, the people in the temple who love their temple kill him. Daniel 11, verse 20. Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor to the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. And in his place a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the Prince of the Covenant. Now, all of this stuff that's going on, this intrigue and all this stuff that God's been telling Daniel about. He's not telling them that because Daniel's bored and they haven't published AD yet, and so this is his soap opera he wants him to have. He's not telling him this so that Daniel, he's telling him this to set this thing up right here. Because what happens is, Antiochus the Third's son, who is what? Seleucus the Fourth, the firstborn son of Seleucus, then tries to raise money through taxing his own people, but he is soon assassinated. So since Antiochus the Third could not raise money to Asia Minor because the Romans stopped him, and then he couldn't raise money by robbing a temple in Susa because they stopped him, his son Seleucus the Fourth's got the problem. He needs money for Rome, and he needs money to pay for all of his wars. So he goes out and puts a heavy tax on his own people, and they assassinate him. That's where it says, in its place one will rise, who will send an oppressor throughout the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, neither in anger nor in battle, be assassinated. Seleucus IV's brother, and what's his name going to be? Going to be Antiochus, because they're all Seleucus or Antiochus. Executes the assassin, murders Seleucus's minor son. That's where it talks about a despicable person on whom the honor of kingship has not been confirmed, but he can come in time of tranquility, and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So he murders the minor son through intrigue, assumes the throne as Antiochus the Fourth. He was also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, whose deeds Jesus refers to in Matthew 24:15. The word Epiphanes means he appears. Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, means he sort of came from nowhere. Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay. So Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, murders his brother's son, and through intrigue captures the kingdom of the Seleucids. Now Jesus refers to this man and his actions as the abomination which makes desolate. He refers to him as the forerunner of the Antichrist. And he looks forward into the future and says, there will come one who will take over by intrigue. And his speech will be all seductive, and he will persuade people, and they will give him all manner of power he doesn't deserve. Remember, that's what Jesus says about the Antichrist. And he says, when you see the abomination which makes desolate, let the reader understand, Matthew 24. In other words, when you see the abomination that makes desolate, they knew he was referring to an event that happened under Antiochus the Fourth, which we'll get to.
What does that mean? I hear that all the time. What's that? Abomination which makes desolate.
I'm going to tell you in just a minute.
Okay.
It's coming up. But when Jesus is referring to the Antichrist in the future, he points backwards to a well-known historical figure out of the book of Daniel, and says the Antichrist of the future is like this guy. He comes on the scene by intrigue. He's persuasive. People believe him. He's a liar, but he's very persuasive about what he does. And he's going to do the same thing that desolates the temple that this guy did, Antiochus the Fourth. Just to answer your question, Antiochus the Fourth set up a statue of Zeus in the temple and slaughtered hogs to it, and caused the temple sacrifice to end for 1150 days. Okay, we'll get to that in just a minute. But when the Antichrist in the middle of the tribulation comes along, he's going to set his own image up in the temple, demand worship, and he's going to cause the sacrifice to cease, just like this guy did. And he says, let the reader understand. So Jesus is telling the Jews, when you see this happen again, you know that's your Antichrist. He's talking to something that's very well known to them. We'll see why in just a minute. Okay?
So the Antichrist has to come out of the East somewhere.
The Antichrist has to come out of the Roman Empire somewhere. The Antichrist, remember when we talked about Daniel earlier, said that the legs of iron and clay, and in the latter days of this kingdom, one will emerge. Well, it's that kingdom, the ten nation kingdom of Rome, from which he will emerge. Common market. That group of people. Those people groups that made up Rome. But the whole prophecy is very cryptic. Mm-hmm. And it only makes sense as it happens. Because if you take this and read it without my explanations, it's just going all over the place. King of the North, King of the South, doing this, there's daughter this, comes in this, but it's just...
And All of this is Daniel's vision.
All of this is Daniel's. This is what the angel's telling Daniel.
And it happens.
Huh?
And it happens.
It all happens. It happens. It's like 200 specific details that happen. One after another, after another, after another. I mean, you know, Nostradamus would come and give you these quadrants, 24 quadrants, about something or another. And if six of them came true, he was considered a prophet.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is about that complex. That's why I said it sounds a lot like Nostradamus. But every one of them comes true. It just falls in place, one after another. And by that, we're meant to give some credence, therefore, to the last half of the prophecy, which is about the end time. So if he was that good, that far,
then he's got to be good.
That's right. Daniel 11:23. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. He will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them. He will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. All right, so this despicable man has no honor, and he schemes incessantly against everyone. He's the type of the Antichrist. And he's going to, his level of iniquity is going to be greater than his father's and greater than the people who come after him. In other words, this is the most iniquitous man, the man of iniquity. Jesus refers to the man of iniquity. This guy's, there's always these television shows about somebody who's just a really wicked schemer. This guy's top banana. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand. For schemes will be devised against him. This is a schemer. It's like he's not just coming out and making straightforward warfare. He's also plotting all kinds of things in this guy's own court. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him. The people who eat the choice food of the king of the south will destroy him. And his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies to each other at the same table, but will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. All right. What happens is that when Cleopatra I dies in 176, Antiochus IV marches against Egypt, and through intrigue, he conquers a superior force in 170 to 169 BC. He becomes the quote-unquote protector of her son, Ptolemy IV, whose name is Philometer. So he takes over and he says, I'm going to be the personal protector of the young king. So in other words, he's planning to control the Egyptian court by being the personal protector of the young king, giving him Antiochus IV control over Egypt. The Egyptians then set up Ptolemy IV's younger brother, Eupator, as an opposition king in fortified Alexandria. Antiochus IV makes a futile attempt to defeat him in Alexandria. When he failed in his attempt, he returned to Jerusalem. He despoiled the temple of much treasure and went home, and the two Egyptian princes become reconciled and they co-reign in Egypt. All right, now this is important. What happens is Antiochus IV goes in and he conquers the puppet king of Egypt, a little boy. He conquers their forces, even though their army was bigger. And then he claims he's going to be his daddy. He's going to be his protector. The Egyptians raise up his brother in Alexandria. And when Antiochus IV goes over to conquer them, he's not successful. So he comes home. Now what happens when you go to warfare and you're not successful is you come home without treasure. And so he goes through Israel, Palestine, on his way back. And says, well, I can't go home empty-handed. And so he loots the country. He takes everything he can of wealth out of the country, which makes him even more hated by the locals than he would ordinarily have been. When he leaves Egypt, these two princes, their two factions reconcile, and they wind up being co-rulers. Now, At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south. But for this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. For the ships of Kittim will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened. So after he licks his wounds, goes home, steals all the treasure out of Israel, reconfigures his army, he goes back against Egypt again. Now he's going up against these two little boys who are lying together, they're co-rulers, they're factions all around them. But they now have an ally, the ships of Kittim, the Romans. The Romans. Kittim is another name for Cyprus. So the Roman army from Cyprus comes in and threatens Antiochus IV. Rearming himself, Antiochus IV makes another attempt to conquer Alexandria, but the Roman ships on Cyprus arrive and tell him to back off. Antiochus capitulates without a fight and falls back on Jerusalem. Now he's mad again. Roman dominance in the Mediterranean grows from this point in time. This is the beginning of Rome's heavy influence in Palestine, Palestinian area. Now, Antiochus will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, and he will take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces from him will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice. They will set up the abomination of desolation, and by smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. All right. This is the crux of the matter, really. So when he goes up this second time against the Egyptians in the south, and the Romans come along and they tell him to go home, when he comes back into Jerusalem, he encounters a celebration of his defeat, which only enrages him. And so he decides he's going to destroy the Jewish culture. So he does a number of things. He tries to set up, he takes all the synagogues and makes them gymnasia, Greek workout places, you know, fellowship halls. He tries to create a 10-day week to get rid of the 7-day week that's there. Because remember, they're more Greco-Roman than they are Jewish. So he tries to create a 10-day week. He goes into the temple, sets up a statue of Zeus, and slaughters hogs to it. And he stops the morning and evening sacrifice for 1,150 days. That's 2,300 sacrifices. The morning and evening sacrifice. That is called the abomination which makes desolate, because it's an abomination which desolated the temple. Desecrated, the word you might reckon. Desecrated temple. Okay. When Jesus refers to the abomination which makes desolate, every Jew, living and dead, knows that he means this event. This event. And when he talks about the man of iniquity, they know he means this king. When he talks about the fact that he wins by intrigue and persuasive words and all of that, they know who he's talking about. And he points forward and he said, when you see him again, you will know that the time of the end is at hand. Let the reader understand. Okay? So, all of this whole prophecy about Daniel, it's all very interesting, and especially as the way it works out history is very interesting. But the important part of it really is that Jesus uses it and refers to it in order to tell us who the Antichrist is going to be. He also tells us things like those who know their God will understand what is happening. Now what happens when he goes in and he does this, and he ends the morning and evening sacrifice at the temple, which was never supposed to stop, sets up this statue, causes the worship to go on there, the slaughter of the hogs, and tries to destroy the culture. When he does this, there are a group of Jewish Hebrew zealots who are zealous for God. Under the leadership of the high priest and his oldest son, Judas the hammer hand. Mattathias is the priest, and he had five sons, and the oldest one was called Judas the Hammer Hand because he was a warrior. And the word Hammer Hand is Maccabeus. So this group of zealots in the priesthood started a counterinsurgency known as the Maccabees, and they waged war against Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, for 3.5 years. And then they defeated him. And at the end of the time when they defeated him, they cleansed the temple and went about the process of reestablishing the morning and evening sacrifice. So after 1,150 days, they drive him out and they cleanse the temple and start the sacrifice, the morning and evening sacrifice, anew. Now, in order to keep the fire burning in the Holy of Holies, in the seven-branch candlestick, it requires an oil that by decree in Leviticus and Deuteronomy has to be made very specifically. It takes 8 days to make this oil, and they only found one vial of it left. So they run this one vial of oil for 8 days, which is a miracle. It shouldn't have lasted anywhere near this long. At the end of that 8 days, when they were bringing their new oil, whatever, then they were going. But that miracle became known as the Feast of Lights, or Hanukkah. In the Bible, it's referred to once as the Feast of Dedication. So Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights, is a celebration of the fact that this vial of oil lasted miraculously for 8 days when they were trying to re-consecrate the temple after this particular event. I'm going to go over that again in a minute, but I just wanted to give you the overview. So Antiochus will return, become enraged at the Holy Covenant, take action. He will come back and show regard for those who forsake the covenant. He makes the most concerted effort of any man, any king at this particular time, to destroy the godly culture and replace it with the culture of the world. It's interesting because we have a culture in this country of a God, a culture of God. And the world has made war on it to try to destroy it. So when you think about the way that the world around us is trying to destroy everything we believe about God, drive it out and replace it with their own set of beliefs, it's just like this. Now, the only way that we're ever going to defeat this culture around us that's trying to destroy it is to take up arms against it by reestablishing our own godliness. It was because the Maccabees went to war against this culture and drove it out that Judaism survived. And in our world, we need to do the same kind of proactive, warlike behavior in order to get our culture back. Unfortunately, the battle needs to happen inside of us, not them. We need to be as aggressive as they were to protect their culture, their godly culture. And the way we would do that is by reestablishing the godly culture among ourselves. We need to make war on ourselves to get the culture of the world out, reestablish the culture of Christ, the kingdom of heaven, in ourselves in order to drive out that culture that's trying to destroy us. So make no mistake about it. There is a concerted effort right now in this country to destroy the Christian culture of this country so that it will disappear, completely disappear, and be replaced by the syncretized culture of secularism, false religion, all that sort of thing. And, you know, the battle is being done in areas like consumerism and television and marketing and, you know, that's, you know, most people aren't inviting you to go to a seance. They're not inviting you to go to a Wiccan party or to go to a witchcraft thing. You know, the people around you are inviting you to join them as they do all these things that fail to honor God and discourage you from doing the things that do honor God. It's subtle. It's the frog in the water, being boiled in the water. All right. So Antiochus Epiphanes he just had enough with these people, and he made the most concerted effort, probably in history, in the Holy Land, to destroy the Jewish people and culture. Their separatism, their holiness, the fact that they were separate unto God. Now there have been many down through history that have tried to destroy Israel. Tried to destroy the Jews. The Nazis are an example. But the Russians were like that, and so were the Spanish, etc., etc. But not in the Holy Land. This is the most... And when Jesus says, when you see this again, then you'll know that the time is... that I'm coming. I'm right behind it. The forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress. He will do away with the regular sacrifice. They will set up an abomination of desolation. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. So, very smoothly, he will persuade people that you don't want to believe all that foolish old stuff about who can sleep with who and who can marry who and all that kind of stuff. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Stuff is happening everywhere, but as far as France and some of those places goes, battle's over there.
Well,
they've already won there. And if they hadn't, it's just because the people who are dead don't know it yet. You know, one of these days they'll wake up and realize they're dead and that'll be the end of it. You know, you've got a very strong center of religion there in Rome, but as far as the people actually, I mean, many of y'all have been in the churches in Europe. You know, it's over. It's over, okay. So there's that. The other part of it is that and there's a way in which I don't really care what's happening over there. That's not happening here that's concerning me. I mean, I do care, but that's beyond my ability to control it. So what's happening here is that, I've watched this happen. I watched, for instance, when I was not so much younger, there was a general consensus that homosexuality was a perversion of lifestyle, that it was unhealthy, could be and should be addressed medically as an illness, and was certainly not acceptable. And then, little by little, I watched grandmother after grandmother after grandmother say, oh, my sweet little grandson, he's got to be okay, it must be fine. And before you know it, it's become taboo to speak against it in any way whatsoever. And then when it gets that kind of support in the mainstream, then it can gather the courts together. Because now what happens is when you ask public opinion about what is right and what is wrong, they'll say, well, of course it's right. That's right. That's right. It was actually not the aggressive legal behavior of homosexuals and their groups that brought this on. It was the capitulation of grandmother after grandmother after grandmother. Because mother after mother after mother. You know, I will not call my son evil. And little by little by little, they said, the Bible says this, but he's my son.
When do we say enough? I mean, when do we know what to say?
We're not going to, hang on just a minute, I'm going to give you the floor. We're not going to win this by fighting them. We're only going to win this by becoming the demonstrable Christian witness that God means for us to. Paul said, I didn't come to you with words, I came to you in power. And we're not going to win this in the court of public opinion, and we're not going to win it in the courts of law. We're not going to do it. The only way we're going to win this is if we become the kind of people that we're supposed to be, where we exhibit the power of God and the grace of God in our lives, which includes, by the way, no hostility and hatred and bitterness, you know, toward people. That's what will make the change, but we're not going to win it legally. You know, that's what the lawyer has to say.
We'll change instead of ourselves.
Yeah, the religious right co-opted churches in order to build a political bastion against all of this in the 70s and the 80s.
It's the same way the Democrats have courted the Socialist Act.
What happened is that that didn't work. They got Ronald Reagan elected, but they did nothing to stop the onslaught against the things of God in that particular process. And unfortunately, many people in the religious right were only interested in getting Ronald Reagan elected because they just used the churches for their purposes. You know, we can mount up, and there are people all around us that are trying to mount up political movements to try to change all of this. And I don't believe it has a snowball's chance in hell to work, because for one thing, it plays right into their hands. See, I believe that what the Lord is saying to us is that only when my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked way, that I will heal from heaven and heal their land. I don't believe God's going to heal our land because we get our politics together. Now, I've been wrong before, Suzanne. You know, I'm telling you what is my bias. I tell you that because I tried my darndest to join and even lead that movement for a long time. Got involved very heavily in the Right to Life and the leadership role and the Action newsletters, all that sort of thing. Next, I went to Washington on a fairly regular basis to go to big meetings about all this kind of stuff. And it, it was a trick. It didn't work. We are who we are in spite of all of that. I mean, I don't know that you could get a stronger political movement that is pro-Christian together today than we had under Jerry Falwell, Phyllis Schlafly, who's the doctor in Denver?
Dobson.
Dr. Dobson, Ralph Reed, Jim McAteer, and all the people who got Reagan elected. I don't know that you could have a better coalition. I mean, we had churches heavily involved in politics all over the place. It was very, very strong. And we got Reagan elected. But, you know, that didn't stem the tide. What I would point to is the strategy of Jesus. Because when Jesus came in among us, he did not rally the political forces. What he did was he lived a manifested life of God in the midst of the people, including dying. But the power in which he lived is what the effectiveness was. If somebody wants to put together a political group, I'm not going to oppose it,
right?
You know, and that sort of thing. I won't spend any time doing it because
right.
I've already wasted that much time. So I just I believe that what God wants is for the church in America to repent. I think the church needs to get a lot smaller and a lot more sincere and centralized in God and spiritually powerful. Because frankly, that's when we did our best work, when we were the minority. And what we were known for is how we loved people and cared for people, and the power of our actions and behaviors versus our words. We always get in trouble when we get to be the minority with all the power. It's spiritual. Well, I totally agree, but remember what we're supposed to teach the children. Jesus said, go into all the world teaching them to observe, not to know.
Well,
teaching them to observe. So what we're supposed to be teaching our children is what to do, not what to know or what to say. What to do. And
that's what all those things that they put on their farms. Oh.
Well, the problem is they got really good at memorizing all the scriptures and quit following God.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, the point is...
I just meant that it's going to be up to the families to take their children and put them in the right direction.
It is, but what the family's got to do is live the life, not just... Because,
well,
you know, I will tell you, we could go gather up all the children for the last 10 years... that went through the Christian schools, and they can tell you what their parents taught them to believe. But what their parents actually did would be something altogether different than that.
That's the internal warfare for the individual.
Yeah. All right, well, back to Mr. Daniel here. I got to move on here. So news of his reversal emboldens the Judeans, who lay siege to Antiochus' handpicked high priest. Antiochus, enraged, comes to Jerusalem, puts down the resistance. He supports the Hellenized liberal Jews who have forsaken the covenant. He desecrates the temple, putting a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Zeus in the Holy of Holies on December 25th, 167 BC. He sacrifices pigs on the altar. He also dedicates the temple to Baal. He stops the morning and evening sacrifices that stoppage lasts 1150 days or 2300 evening and mornings. But the followers of Yahweh rise up in defiance, especially the Maccabees. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end of time, because it is still to come as the appointed time. All right. Mattathias, an Orthodox priest from a town near Jerusalem, kills a Syrian officer who is coming to enforce the pagan sacrifice in the temple. He and his five sons, including Judas the Hammer, lead an insurgent force against the Syrians and their Jewish collaborators for 3 years. Against overwhelming odds and the cost of many lives, they prevail. On December 25th, 164 BC, they cleanse and rededicate the temple. These hard and difficult times purge Israel's religious practice and lead to resurgence of Pharisaism, a strict adherence to the laws of Moses. It is all of the persecution they go through that ultimately purges the synchronized religious practices of the Christians, I mean the Jews. This stuff that we're going through is going to eventually get worse. And as it gets worse, it's going to purify us going to purify the church. Church will get smaller, but more committed. It'll cost us more to be a Christian, but those who are Christians will be more committed. For all practical purposes, Israel enjoys independence for the next 100 years until Rome conquers them in 63 BC under Pompey. The Feast of Hanukkah is derived from this period. An oil lamp must burn at all times in the Holy of Holies. The oil must be ritually pure and dedicated for this purpose. Only one qualified vial of oil could be found for the rededication. Miraculously, it is believed the single one-day vial burned for 8 days until some more could be produced. Henceforth, Hanukkah means dedication was celebrated from 25 Kislev to 2 Adar, that is December 25th to January 2nd. Hanukkah traditionally occurs near at the same time as the Christian celebration of Christmas. It's also known as the Feast of Lights or the Feast of Dedication, as is mentioned in the New Testament, John 10:22.
Is there a significance to them moving in and desecrating the temple on December 25th and then retaken on December 25th?
I think it's just interesting.
Okay.
It's just interesting. They celebrate Hanukkah at that time because of that's when it happened.
Yeah.
And we celebrate Christmas on December 25th because Constantine said so.
Okay.
So all during the real time when all this stuff was happening, did anybody ever go back and read the book of Daniel and know what was going to happen?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure as these things unfolded that the Jewish scholars and the people who were in the evangelicals among them
were
going, this is what Daniel said was going to happen.
Yeah.
This is what Daniel said. I mean, I think what's happening is they'd be going, you know, this is just the exact fulfillment of that. And I think it sort of foretells what will happen among us. I think as things happen, those because the Bible talks about those who, if the time, if even the elect cannot be deceived, the elect are going to understand. It's basically a paraphrase of it. But that as things go on, what's going to happen is that those who are trying to walk with God and follow God, they're going to look at this and say, this is a fulfillment of what Jesus said was going to happen in this and this and this. So I think they're going to recognize things as they happen. Jesus said, I tell you these things so that when they happen, you will have peace.
Well, this was such a long vision he had, and it's all, how can you look at this and not know that God foretold all of this?
Yeah, you know, it's always amazing, but we think that intelligence ought to be able to figure this out, and it always comes back to revelation. It always comes back to revelation, because once I understand something, I can't imagine how anybody else can understand it.
You
know? Yeah, and that, you know, that would include how to play one note trump and bridge, you know.
Make a hole in one.
But so the point is that it's once we have revelation, it makes perfect sense. But I don't know that we get to much revelation through perfect sense.
Well, to do it like you have done it, where we see what Daniel said and we see what actually happened. I don't know.
We had to do it after the fact.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have had no clue or no capacity or to even guess what all this was going to mean until it unfolded and I could look backwards on it and see. And probably sometime after it unfolded. In other words, not like last week. Hey, did you see Antiochus Epiphanes just killed whatever?
Some of the Jewish scholars had to be seeing this.
Well, remember that everybody was reading the book of Daniel backwards, including the Magi. All righty. Yes, huh?
So Antioch Epiphanes comes from the north?
The Seleucid Empire. All of the Seleucids. And think Syrian for your purpose.
Okay.
Think Syria, although it's much bigger than modern Syria.
Okay.
Think Syria and Egypt for purposes, location purposes. Anybody named Antiochus and Seleucus comes from there. Anybody named Ptolemy comes from the south. It's this battle back and forth between the north and the south, with Palestine being the battlefield and the walkway, and back and forth, back and forth. The key event in all of this is the rule reign of Antiochus Epiphanes and what all happened, and his concerted effort. Now, all of them tried. It was only a couple of them that actually supported the Jewish lifestyle and religion. Many of them tried to suppress it at some level of intensity.
Okay.
They tried to persuade it away or whatever. But Antiochus Epiphanes tried to stomp it out.
Okay.
And all the things that he did, Yeah, and that's the main reason why that's important is because Jesus uses it as his main example of how we should know that the time has come.
Okay.
That when you see this,
okay,
let the reader understand,
okay,
it says in Matthew 24.